And in fairness to Jessica, the job of the editor-in-chief is to always have the back of their writers. So she's saying, like, we got it right. What did we technically get wrong? And it reminds me of the story we talked about the other day where, you know, they put the MAGA hats on Felicia and Ben Horowitz. And I said, you know, that could have been more clear. But somebody, you know, like the editor-in-chief is probably like, hey, listen, it's obvious because there's two blue Smurfs on there. You know, people, that's an illustration. And we put in the, you know, tiny little minus one font size that this is an illustration. So, you know, people defend themselves. The truth here is the company feels like it's a little shady.
Oh, Jason, going with the British understatement there. A little shady. Dude, this firm is essentially underneath a canopy of trees. There is so much required shade to discuss it.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Lemon.io. Hire pre-vetted remote developers. Get 15% off your first 4 weeks of developer time at lemon.io/twist. .tech domains. Don't miss our Jam with JCal contest. To apply and get more details, go to jamwithjcal.tech. Brought to you by .tech domains. And Command Bar. Seamlessly integrate an AI-powered guide into your software, making navigation intuitive and interactive. Visit commandbar.com/twist to get a custom live demo.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to This Week in Startups. He's Alex Wilhelm. I'm Jason Calacanis. We are going to talk about a lot of news today. This Week in Startups, you can find us on all the major podcast platforms and YouTube and TikTok and all those other places for clips. But what do we got on the docket today? What are we going to talk about?
So we're going to start with the current kind of cause of the day, the thing people are talking about, which is the information, a scoop on Bolt, what's real, what's not, and some criticism of them. Mm. It's kind of what's trending on Twitter today, or X, if you will. Then Waymo and their rapid growth, and also a couple notes on open source self-driving, which is a whole new category that I dug into today for us. Then we're going to talk about layoffs. And then from there, we have some notes on a major deal that happened called Tabular. Databricks bought it, some notes on that. But first things first, Jason, people are beefing.
Okay, so this brouhaha, I saw Sheil, I think Monat is how you pronounce his last name, I'm not sure. I've met him once, nice guy. He has been getting into it with everybody. Explain what's going on here.
All right, so The Information is a technology news website. I have a bunch of friends that work there. I'm sure everyone's heard of it. It's behind a paywall. They have a kind of a hard paywall model, a bit like the Financial Times, if you will. And they have a focus on scoops. And when they broke some news yesterday that Bolt was seemingly raising $450 million at a $14 billion valuation, it sent enormous waves around the world of technology because, one, everyone thought Bolt was doomed. The CEO, Ryan Breslau, originally a co-founder who left, got sued, was supposed to be coming back. And then also the dollar amount didn't make any sense. Who's going to give this company $450 million? And then also the valuation didn't make any sense because why would it be worth $3 billion more than it was when it was a much seemingly healthier company back in the day? So Jason, my thought reading this was, huh? What the hell? And I didn't want to I hadn't done any reporting on it. So I didn't want to say to my friends, well, what's this? But I was very perplexed when I saw the headline.
Certainly perplexing. Let's start with, what does Bolt do? This is a fintech startup, was founded in 2014. The guy who started is Ryan Breslau. He is a unique snowflake in all the world. He's the guy who said that Y Combinator, Paul Graham, and everybody were part of some bully stack. They were like the mafia in tech, and they were trying to kill Bolt. There was another startup called Fast, and what these, I guess, startups did was when you get to a checkout, the idea is to help you check out faster. And I see this all the time because I guess Shopify, when I buy a shirt like this one from Roan or Cuts or some of these brands, and I go to log in, it already has me cookied and I'm logged in already. And then it sends me an SMS on the checkout page and says, hey, just type in this SMS code to your phone number and we'll verify it's you through two-factor and you're off to the races. That makes it really brisk to check out. That reduces friction and merchants like that because if you have to put in your credit card, log in every time, it's a pain in the neck. So there was Fast. I think that company went under. There was Bolt. and there's Amazon checkout and Shopify checkout. So there's big players in this, and then there were these upstart players. I thought these companies had gone out of business, I'm being honest.
Well, there wasn't a lot of revenue behind them, but there was a lot of, I think, enthusiasm at the time for making e-commerce faster, easier, cheaper, better. Because keep in mind that we're talking about the 2021 era, which was very close to COVID, supply chain disruptions, people ordering more. A lot of future e-commerce growth got pulled forward in the market. And so everyone was like, oh man, we gotta get on this. I think if memory serves, the thing that made these companies look very attractive was they told people, hey, we are building out this enormous user base as we do one-click checkout, a network. But I think what they were doing was they were creating profiles for people for them when they checked out using Bolt or Fast or whatever. So it wasn't like Jason was going to a website and signing up for Bolt. He was just trying to buy something somewhere else. And then they were counting him as now a Bolt user. And so to me, there was always a little bit of BS in this, but also fundamentally, Jason, point solution, incumbent competition, and I would say to some degree replicable by a functional development team. So the companies got big, raised money, and then kind of fell apart. And so when they sit there back, it just, not a single ounce of it seemed to mesh with my understanding of where the market is today and where e-commerce is today.
And just to give people back to the business model, you as a merchant, let's say you were 1% of the user base, like you were a large merchant and you had a million customers, and Bolt aspired or Fast aspired to have 100 million customers, and you were contributing your million customers to, you know, their checkout. You would then also be paying Fast or Bolt, in this case, Bolt, I think a transaction fee, I think it was 2% or something. So now you're paying 2 or 3% for your credit card, 2% to Bolt. Maybe you're paying some amount of shipping and everything like that. So that 2%, depending on the business, could be material. And I guess that's why people got excited about this. Hey, what if a certain number of transactions go through this? And every time you get a new user, if you were doing Acme company, I was doing Delta company, and let's say we had no overlap. You know, you were selling sneakers and I was selling coffee mugs, you know, thermoses, and we had zero overlap. You would be saving me time. And I would be saving you time if our users went to each other's website. So that's kind of cool, I guess. But I never thought the value prop was that good. I'll be totally honest. I don't know that this was like an actual acute problem in the world. I don't think it was.
I think everyone just wanted Amazon's one-click checkout solution. They wanted to bring it to their website. And I think, you know, when we were watching Amazon at that time post those insane growth numbers, everyone wanted a bite of the apple, you know? And maybe people were being pressured to have exposure to the burgeoning e-commerce startup sectors. They wanted to pick one company to back, whatever. But in the end, a lot of capital got effectively incinerated. And in the case of Bolt, when they raised that really, really large Series E, some of their investors said, hey, we think that you were not entirely upfront and clear about your company's performance to date, and therefore we bought in at too high of a price. And then there was also, Jason, there was a loan from the company to the founder. So here's a question for you. If one of your founders that you've invested in came to you and said, hey, Jason, we just raised a bunch of money. I want to loan myself $30 million from the company. What would be your response?
Yeah, that's dangerous because you now have a CEO with $30 million in their pocket and they have to pay interest on that loan and they're distracted, right? So there's the distraction of $30 million in somebody's pocket. Also, somebody didn't buy the shares. It's a loan. So now if the CEO goes and blows that money and can't pay it back, what do you do? The CEO comes to you and says, hey, listen, by the way, I blew through the 30. I need another 30. I can't service the 30. Like, I need you to extend the loan. And then you have board members who are massively conflicted because they have to manage the CEO. And let's say the CEO is not doing a good job and you want to fire them, but they have a $30 million loan. You call the loan when you fire them. Let's say the CEO is doing a great job and he says, I want a $100 million loan. It is ridiculously bad hygiene. That's why other parties, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, whatever, might give somebody, and you saw this in the WeWork TV show, some third party bank who says, hey, Bolt shares are worth this, WeWork shares are worth that. I'll give you a $100 million line of credit against your private company stock. They'll do that with the venture capitalists. I've had people come to me and say, hey, this is what your holdings, your future potential on the first four venture funds are. you know, do you want to have a loan that you can go start spending some money and pay us, you know, when it was 2 or 3%, no big deal, but now 6, 7, 8%, a little bit of a bigger deal, bigger VIG. So your company has to be growing faster than that VIG, a little bit harder to do in a higher rate environment. But it's just horrific, terrible, disastrous conflicts on a board of a private company. As we say in the business, no conflict, no interest. So what happens is board members sometimes will pay off, bribe, otherwise influence the founder by giving them these kind of loans or buying their shares. And it's really problematic. I'll leave it at that.
The way that this was described to me back in the day was secondary is a bad idea. It disaligns incentives, full stop. The exception being if you want to de-risk a founder with $500K, $1 million, something small so they can school, a house, something very basic, enough money to give them more focus on the business and less distractions in their personal life. That was the only exception made to me.
10% of your holdings, $10 million, no problem in my mind. So if your holdings were worth $1 billion and you sold 10, 20, 30 million, no problem. If you sold 100 million, now you're like, well, this person's buying jets. They're distracted and maybe they don't care about the outcome as much. So that's the balance that people find. Right now, startups have to do more with less. We all know that. And founders have to be smart with how they deploy capital. Investors are very tuned in to being capital efficient. So if you need great tech talent, but you don't have the time to interview dozens and dozens and dozens of candidates, you need to check out Lemon.io. They have thousands of on-demand developers to choose from, and these devs are vetted. And their experience, and most of all, they're results-oriented. They're going to get you the result you're looking for. They're not going to leave you hanging. And guess what? They charge competitive rates. Great developers can be incredibly hard to find. We all know that. And when you do find them, it can be hard to integrate them into your team, but Lemon.io will handle all of that for you. Startups choose Lemon.io because they only offer handpicked developers with 3 or more years of experience and strong portfolios. In fact, only 1% of candidates who apply get in. And if something ever goes wrong, Lemon.io will get you a replacement ASAP. A couple of launch founders have worked with Lemon.io and they've had great experiences. So here's your call to action. Go to lemon.io/twist to find your perfect developer or tech team in 48 hours or less. And Twist listeners get 15% off their first 4 weeks. Stop burning money. Hire developers smarter. Visit lemon.io/twist.
Also, just a note about this. People borrow money against their public equity holdings all the time. And that makes way more sense. If you're thinking about this, they're liquid and you can tell what they're worth minute by minute. Private shares are illiquid, harder to value, and as Jason said, much more conflicted. Anyways, the company is probably not raising the 450. The investors don't appear to be entirely, they're not your Sequoias, Jason. These are not firms that we expect to have this kind of capital.
And this was all in a letter to shareholders, right? The preferred shareholders got a letter and it said, and I'm looking at this newcomer, Eric Newcomer's story.
Love Eric.
We are finalizing a $450 million Series F funding round from UAE and UK-based investment firms. Okay, that's weird because they're just describing geographies, not the actual firms, which right. will elevate our total valuation to over $14 billion, a considerable leap from our $11 billion valuation during Series E1 round in 2022. That's a little bit weird language, by the way. Considerable leap. Who wrote this? In addition to the investment from these investment firms, two investments in 5 words, not good. We just say, in addition to the investment from these firms, Bolt may receive additional amounts from existing Bolt investors who may participate in Series F funding round.
Yes. And this is where we get to the pay-to-play bit. So keep going.
Information around with a credulous headline this morning. Bolt near deal to raise $450 million at $14 billion. They have since updated the story. So I guess this is where maybe they felt that headline was not accurate or they didn't do enough work. What do you think next is important here?
So then Sheel, an investor okay. that you know and that I know, and I don't want to be in the game of you know, pumping up VCs, but Sheel is, in my experience, very nice and patient and has given
me... Oh, he's a kind guy. Yes.
Yeah. He's given me time when he doesn't need to. And so I bring that up just because when he goes critical on Twitter, it's not a normal thing for him. He's not a guy who's out there flinging mud usually. Anyways, Sheetal said that the information kind of rushed out this story. Here's his tweet that we're talking about right now. And that he says then it wasn't true. The money and investors aren't real. Eric got the story right. Okay. And then he says, look, I would have been completely fine with it if they acknowledged they got it wrong and issued a rejection. Instead, he says Jessica Lesson, who runs the information, was smug in his words and incorrect, saying that the details were correct. And then he's like, hey, yeah, but they edited it afterwards. Then we get to a response here, Jason. Jessica responds, and then he goes, look, one, when accused of smugness, don't start with as said yesterday. I'm referring to the piece, not the headline. And then two, he says, you know, we all make mistakes. People in your newsroom disagree with you on this. And so the bump bump sound you just heard was Sheel throwing his friends under the bus, because that bus is going to back right back up to the newsroom with Jessica.
That's going to be an interesting editorial meeting tomorrow morning.
Glad I'm not going to be in that one. I do really, though, agree. And I wanted to read all that because I think Sheel is dead on. If you make a mistake, people actually, I think, have a pretty big band for saying, oh, okay, cool. If you go like, watch this, I made a mistake, my bad, we're going to fix it. But there is this era in the current moment that we're in, and this goes way beyond Jessica, to be clear. People, we're in the age of bluster and BS and no shame. And I do think this is partially driven by our recent political climate. But I think people just have this, like, you know, show no weakness, never admit a weakness or a mistake, always punch back twice as hard. And it just, I don't think, always leads to the results that people would like. And I think this is one of those cases.
You are referring to the Trump playbook of never apologize. They hit, you hit twice as hard. You know, he's a counterpunch or whatever they say about him. And so, yeah, I think, and in fairness to Jessica, the job of the editor-in-chief is to always have the back of their writers. So she's saying, like, we got it right. What did we technically get wrong? And it reminds me of the story we talked about the other day where, you know, they put the MAGA hats on Felicia and Ben Horowitz. And I said, you know, that could have been more clear, but somebody, you know, like the editor-in-chief is probably like, hey, listen, it's obvious because there's two blue Smurfs on there. You know, people, that's an illustration. And we put in the, you know, tiny little minus one font size that this is an illustration. So, you know, people defend themselves. The truth here is the company feels like it's a little shady.
Oh, Jason, going with the British understatement there. A little shady. Dude, this firm is essentially underneath a canopy of trees. There is so much required shade to discuss it. Okay, Ryan also went out and founded another company called Love that he raised money for. I wonder what it would be like to wake up with the sheer level of confidence that some people have in their own infallibility. Because
ask Adam Newman.
I've never met Adam.
These are the same type of entrepreneurs, which it's like I threw a Hail Mary pass one time, right? So the Hail Mary in this case might be that series E, F, you know, two or whatever in peak Zurb when they hit $11 billion. And then they think, well, I can hit half court shots. I'm Steph Curry. I should shoot from the logo. Steph Curry doesn't shoot from the logo. He shoots as close to the 3-point line as he can get an open shot from. He's not saying like I'm just because I can and I have hit a full court shot, a half court shot. That's not my default. I'm going to try to, you know, be a consistent, disciplined player. And so, yeah, this guy's a little bit effervescent, and the firm seems a bit, on its surface, shady. When I read the language there, you know, you and I are writers. We pay attention. The person who wrote that was not a good writer. Just from that little thing where, you know, they say these investment firms, those are little details that tell me this is not well written or edited. And then to say a UAE firm, that's like saying a Canadian firm. What does that even tell you as a preferred investors? Like, they could have said Middle Eastern investors. They could have MENA investors, European investors. I mean, it just, the whole thing screams. And then that pumping it up, like, what did he say? It's an extreme increase in valuation. Like, when I hear that kind of nonsense.
I think he said leap.
A leap, you know, like. That's not how normal people talk about fundraising. When you talk about fundraising, you just say, we're raising X amount. You don't have to say it's a considerable leap. That's almost like trying to get somebody to invest. And you have to be very careful about that, because if you're trying to influence people in making their investment decision, then the way the law starts to work is maybe you'll get held to a higher standard because you're giving investment advice. I just got a secondary offering from a venture firm I'm in. Very high profile venture firm, very high profile deal. And they were saying, we are considering selling some of our shares in this company. You are in this fund. You have the ability to request to sell a certain percentage of your shares. Please, this is not investment advice. Please consult with your lawyer, accountant, financial advisors to make the best decision for you and your circumstances. We cannot give you investment advice. Like, it is written by a lawyer and it is not saying a considerable leap. They're not steering the witness. This is why when I do J trading on the program, I'm going to bring J trading back next year. I was very happy with my performance. I beat Nancy Pelosi. I think that's big since, you know, I don't have any insider information. JTrading.com. But JTrading.com is going to start in January again, and I'm going to get some of your advice here of what I should be J trading. But when I was doing the J trading, I just told people, like, here's what I'm thinking, but don't copy my trades unless you're doing it with money you can afford to lose, because I've never publicly actively traded. I've always been a private market investor and index funds for everything else. So anyway. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk.
No, I appreciate it. The last thing I want to say about this is the technology watching media world just seems much smaller than it used to be. Because here we have like The Information, right? And we have Eric and his newsletter, Newcomer, which is very good. And, I guess TechCrunch could have weighed in. VentureBeat's still there kind of somewhere. But I mean, like, it's not... I remember the blog days, man, when there was like, you remember like the GigaOm network, and like there was just so many more properties and more voices and more like discussion, and it just felt more alive than it does now. And I wonder if I'm just looking at like what's left of media, and just I'm slightly disappointed that there's just so few names out there. Like, I'm glad The Information is doing well. They hired some of my friends. They hired two of my last co-hosts on my last show, jerks. I cannot speak highly enough about the staff over there. But I mean, it's not that huge. Information can't have more than like, what, I don't know, 50, 60 people. And it just made me kind of sad.
Let me make you less sad. I have been through this 3 or 4 times. I had my Silicon Valley Reporter print magazine. I had Engadget, sold it to AOL. I helped Mike with TechCrunch in the early days. We did the conference together, yada, yada. This Week in Startups for 12 years and All In, and now the Twist 500. I have, you know, been in the mix in this and watched it over the years. And what I'll tell you is there is the media business got rocked because advertising works better, much better. Advertising works much better on TikTok, Amazon, Uber, Meta, and of course Google than it does on TechCrunch or Business Insider or, you know, pick your publication, VentureBeat. What that did was it took a business that had a lot of independence and an enormous amount of people throwing money at them for advertising. And to the point at which, you know, TechCrunch writers started making 6 figures. Some of the top ones were, you know, there was a competition to see who could fund them versus who could land them as, you know, writers. When the advertising went away, the whole thing blew up. And now it's creative destruction. And what you'll see is there's still a need for news. There's still a need to understand the world. So we're doing that here. We have the Twist 500, and we're going to hire a writer full-time to just work on the Twist 500 and to cover each of those companies, maybe do one company a day, interview them, and then add that to the database. So we're taking a database approach and the podcast approach, new model. Jessica with The Information, she worked at the Wall Street Journal. She hired all those people. She's like, you know what? If you can't afford $300 a year, we're not for you. Full stop. So she has less audience, but she's got to have how many subscribers? 10,000?
Oh, a good number. I don't actually know 20? That metric. I haven't pumped that out of my friends yet, but you know, there are two ways you can go. One today is ads. One is subscriptions. And I spent, you know, years at TechCrunch, actually is the thing I did there when I went back, building a subscription business into the 7 figures. It's tough.
It's hard.
It's a grind. We got there. TechCrunch eventually chose to go a different certain path.
Particularly hard, though, if you're doing both at the same time.
Yeah, that is a tension that I could never resolve.
Well, then you're sitting there and the tension is, does this story go behind the paywall or on the free site? The advertising sales team's like, put it on the free site, get more page views. And the sales and the subscription team's like, no, it's a scoop, put it back here. And then the author is like, well, I want the maximum number of people to read it. And then everybody rips it off, rehashes it, and it gets aggregated. And everybody's like, well, I only need the first three sentences here. Scheel is doing such a good job summarizing. You don't need to subscribe to the information. If anything's important in the information, it's going to get summarized in Business Insider or on Twitter, and you don't need to have it. The end.
That is a good breakdown of the incentives, conflicts, and issues thereof. But I do think, though, to have a successful business, you have to pick a lane and just do it. Because the tension about in front of or behind the paywall, I was the guy for years who went to people and was like, may I please put a paywall on your story? No? Okay. Like, I mean, that was, you know, you go home with your hat in hand quite a lot. Now, I had a team that was just behind the paywall, but we needed more total stuff, you know? So anyways, it's difficult. And I hope that everyone can learn from this and we can all do better down the road. And I really do hope that there is not $450 million in very dumb money that people would put into Bolt, because I can think of a lot of things I could do better with that.
I want to know the revenue from this company. And I just want to point out, Scheel did another follow-up. Who knows what's true here or not. I'm not saying Scheel would ever lie or anything like that, but I'm wondering what exactly is going on here. Here is, if we could pull this up, his update. And this update came out August 20th, yesterday at 7 p.m., so it was last night. The actual deal proposed is even wilder. Shareholders had less than 2 days to approve a pay-to-play deal. We've talked about those here before. They'd need to invest more money into the company or Bolt buys their shares for next to nothing. What this means is the existing shareholders, if they don't put more money in, those shares get wiped out, right? And so that's pay-to-play. Breslow would get a $2 million bonus for returning as CEO. What? Doesn't he own a lot of the company? Plus an additional $1 million of back pay. What? Isn't he already rich? Why would they be giving him $3 million? $750,000 of back reimbursements and an $80,000 monthly travel security budget? This can't be right.
What?
This cannot be right. Is this
security? Who does he think he is? Taylor freaking
Swift?
Okay,
this must be comedy, right? This is a joke. Scheel's making a joke here. Yeah, it's got to be a joke. Bolt would invest in Breslow's other company, Love, an eco-friendly marketplace. The terms are amazing. Bolt would invest $15 billion in Love at a $1 trillion. Okay, so he's joking here, I guess.
But then the rest of this seems pretty reasonable. Like, you know, lost $100 million. I can see that.
$250 million on the thing. The article claims that Brad Pamnani, who refers to as representing Abu Dhabi PE funds, but whose LinkedIn says he's with Silver Bear, an investment bank, plans to invest $200 million in London fund, would give $250 in marketing-related services. Okay, so this is all BS.
Joe Lonsdale replies to that tweet, goes, can't tell if this is satire. Yeah, Joe, we feel you.
We're literally saying, is this satire? And when I said shady before, and you were like, you know, it's almost like they're in the Amazon, and those trees go up like 100, and there's a canopy, and then all the leaves, like when you're really on the bottom there, like pretty darn shady. Cloudy day shady in the Amazon.
I wouldn't put $5 into Bolt at a 1.4, let alone a 14. So, like, I mean, you're just sitting here scratching your head. But it does, again, remind me of how much fun we had in 2021 as a broader ecosystem, because my gosh, was it a good time.
Okay, founders, I had Ramsey from Uptrends AI on the pod last week for a jam session. What's a jam session? It's where the founder pitches me their company and I ask them questions and we try to move the ball forward. We try to help them solve their problems. I was fascinated by what he's building because it's helpful for trading stocks, right? And even better, it uses one of those gorgeous dot tech domains. So if you want to come on and tell me about what you're building, have your startup featured here on This Week in Startups, join me. Join the Jam with JCal contest, jamwithjcal.tech. We need a couple more people. You have to have under $2 million in funding, and you got to grab one of those great .tech domains. Head to jamwithjcal.tech and tell me what you're building, and then we'll have you come on the podcast like Ramsey did. Okay, and then you pitch the world, and it's great. Don't forget to get a great .tech domain name. Apply for the Jam with JCal session at jamwithjcal.tech.
All right, let's talk about some good news. So I'm an enormous fan, Jason, of self-driving cars. Can't wait for them to be everywhere.
Me too.
Take the teenagers out of the SUVs. We don't need kids in tanks. let's do this. Now, back in May, Waymo said that they had 50,000 paid rides each week. Then June comes around. Waymo says, if you're in SF, it's now open. Come aboard, hop into your Waymo. Let's go. Then in August, they said they've now surpassed 100,000 paid trips per week. So a doubling from May to August with the addition of more space in San Francisco. But to me, that smells like product market fit, massive consumer demand.
Yeah.
And I would say, given that there haven't been more headlines about Waymo's running it into children or dogs, that the tech is working at that level of capacity. Very exciting.
Yeah, it's really great to see all this autonomous stuff working, which is awesome. And if you hitting 100,000 rides a week across three cities, I believe it's across three cities, right? LA, San Francisco, and then Phoenix, Arizona. Now, you have to put all this in context. And we did this on a previous show. Uber is doing a 250,000 rides per week. 250,000 rides per week. Okay. So 1% of 250 million is 2.5. Okay. And 0.1% would be 250. So Waymo is doing 10 basis points, right? 0.1%, I think, of what Uber's doing right now. Uber is doing less than 1% of all rides in the United States, like globally. So ride sharing, as opposed to driving your own car, is like literally 1% of the overall market of rides. So, you know, people are asking, like, how does this affect your Uber investment? You're still long Uber. Of course, I'm still long Uber. They're still growing 30, 40% a year in terms of rides. I think what's happening is this next generation or two will not have driver's licenses, and they certainly won't own cars, and autonomous will be part of the mix. I drive Tesla full self-driving every day. I can tell you it is absurdly impressive. It's got, I would say, 9 out of 10 miles dialed in. It does not have that last mile. And those are going to be really the hard ones. So I don't think the Tesla full self-driving can be as meaningful as Waymo is. I think Waymo has a lot more experience right now, but I do think in China and some other places, there'll be others. And I think BYD is going to be the big player here. Uber has ordered 100,000 of those electric vehicles with them that have autonomy. There's 6 or 7 players in China doing autonomy. So I think China will be the big market for this. And I think we will go from 1% of rides being done by Lyft, Uber, Waymo, et cetera, to 10%. And then the question is, you know, what percentage does Uber get of that next 9%? My guess is they get 3 or 4 of the next 9%, which would put them at half the market share, because there are 7 or 8 people, I think, who are going to reasonably get to the promised land. Of those 7 or 8 people, I would say, let's just say it's 8 people get there in the next 36 months. They're not going to be able to build enough cars for the entire market. I think of those 8, 5 of them will just put their cars into the Uber and Lyft marketplaces. They'll just go to Uber and Lyft and say, how many do you want? And depending on jurisdiction, they'll get deployed there. And you know, then there's the cost. Then there's the cost of these cars is the other main issue. Waymos are like over $100,000 all in, and they have to be cleaned. They have to be maintained. And in the Uber or in the ride sharing model, those are the existing cars that people own. They're being used when they're sitting there, typically unused for some portion of time. The maintenance, the storage of the car, the cleaning of the car, that's all maintained by the Uber driver or the Lyft driver, DoorDasher, et cetera. So I think this will grow to 10% of the market, which means Uber will be 5 times bigger, is my basic premise in the next 10 years. Uber is 5 to 10 times bigger and has 5 to 10% of all markets. And then I think Tesla could be number 2 or even number 1. But I think the big winner is Uber and BYD. I think people are underestimating BYD.
Where do you, so in this stack rank of major companies that we know, Uber, Tesla, Waymo, and BYD, and then also Baidu with its Apollo Go taxis, which are in Wuhan, and actually I think there's 500 of them live there now. Where does Waymo fit into this ranking? Because you didn't put them into your top 2 there, which surprised me. Are they 3rd or 4th?
Oh, no, I think they'll be top 3. Yeah. I think it's Uber, Waymo, Tesla will be the 3, and BYD, those are your top 4 right there. Cruise seems to be asleep at the wheel, so to speak. you know, I think there'll be a long tail of other players. I actually think this could all become commodified if somebody starts an open source project that actually works in the way Android does. So then you might have like a high-end version of this, like the iPhone version, which would be Tesla and Waymo. And then you might have this incredible global Androidification of the industry where BYD or somebody decides, you know what, we're going to open source this whole thing. And, you know, that's that suddenly then all at once concept in technology.
Yeah. And so we looked into open source self-driving, and there are a couple of names that are worth looking at. One is called Comma AI.
Yep.
This might be
the
coolest company that I hadn't heard of in my life. So if you haven't heard of them, what they do is they have an open source bit of software. They raised about $18 million. Actually, ironically enough, they raised 3.1 from Andreessen back in 2016, to go way back in time. But they've open source software, and then they'll sell you a kit, which we have up on the screen right now, called the Comma 3X. And you just stick it in the front and back of your car, and you can have a car that has automated lane centering, adaptive cruise control, and lane change assist, not level 4 self-driving, to be clear, Jason. But it's going to keep getting better. They do claim to have over 100 million miles driven. So I wonder if you're right. The core substance here does get commodified, a bit like how LLMs are now all pretty good. And then the question then becomes, how do you defend it? How do you make it better? But to me, like, once you solve this, is there really a better way to do it? Like navigation, I'm sure that Bing Maps and Google Maps are roughly as good at getting me directions to Boston from my house, right?
And so, Open Maps is going to be, there's an open mapping project. So the open mapping project, Comma AI, we had George Hotz, H-O-T-Z, on the podcast 8 years ago, 8 years ago with Comma AI. And he actually almost went to work for Tesla. I think there was a little dance publicly there. But yeah, I do think these open source projects, the commodification in China, Tesla has a massive fleet already out there waiting to be woken up. That's their secret sauce. And, you know, the thing about Tesla is when they do figure this out, they have, I think, $30 billion in cash. They could just say, you know what, if you want to buy Teslas, feel free. And hey, but we're going to just produce 1 million cars a year and put them into the robo fleet. And then next year we'll put 2 million into robo fleet. Next year we'll put 3 billion. And Waymo can't do that. So you have Waymo with a head start in terms of the number of rides, but they have to buy, are they on Volvos, Audis? I forgot what they're using. And then I guess they're going to make their own eventually in partnership with people. But you understand, like, you'll have to make these things, put them into service. And then a large portion of the time they're unused. And then there's peak times. And so, you know, it's going to be, it's almost like thinking about e-commerce, right? If you were looking at Target, Walmart, and Amazon, you know, and we were sitting here in 1999, 2000, 2001, 2003, 4, would you want to own those stocks? And the answer is, yeah, those three figured it out. And right now, man, do those three companies crush it on e-commerce, right? People are constantly going to those three websites and shipping stuff to their house. So, you know, now you probably would want Amazon as your number one, but you would also want to own those other two stocks.
Yeah. I did a fact check on your Tesla cash thing. I regret to inform you, Jason, that you greatly underestimated. It's not $30 billion in cash. It's $30.7 billion. Come on, man. You got to do better than that. That's 700.
I mean, it's just so weird. I have this like really weird thing where I remember certain numbers.
No, you were very close. And $30 billion, to your point, is 6x what Alphabet has committed to Waymo, because they dropped in another $5 billion as a commit during their last earnings call, which was a lot of money, to be clear. $5 billion is $5 billion. But Tesla has a lot of money. So I'm excited about this. One last note, AutoWare is another open source project founded back in 2015 by Shinpei Kato at Nagoya University. And they are building something that I couldn't actually get my mitts around as much, because it isn't like a hardware project. It's an open source driving thing. Anyways, the point there is lots of folks are working on this. And so hopefully we do have a slowly then suddenly thing coming up, because my
God. Gonna save a lot of lives too. That's the best part of all this. So, you know, I mean, listen, I believe I've been telling people, I think Uber hits $88.88 in the next year. And because I like the number 88, this is good luck. So when I buy in and I play poker, I buy $8,800 typically, because it's good luck. So 8888, I think, is it. And then I think 10 years from now, we might be looking at it, you know, an Uber stock that's $888. Why? I just like the number eight.
So numerology has come to twist. We are now just strip. I like the number four. So I'm going to go with, well, I mean, look.
Anyway. But
you're a gambler. I'm a gambler. I get it. Mm. I get it.
Okay, founders, we all know that building software is really hard. And so is getting people used to your code. Worse, training new users to use your software intelligently can feel downright insurmountable. And I have to tell you, most tools built to help users get up to speed with new software are annoying, like chatbots that users don't like, or maybe they just ignore them. Thankfully, one company uses generative AI to help users onboard without annoying them, and that startup is called Command Bar. It has this incredible chatbot that gives personalized responses to user questions instead of like a basic Q&A. So it will show your users around your product like a live guide, a guide by your side. And Command Bar can detect when a user needs a nudge, right? So it's kind of watching, saying, hey, maybe I should give them a product hint or maybe a special offer to close a sale. And Command Bar is used by a lot of the unicorns you know, like HashiCorp, Gusto, Sixth Sense, AngelList, and others. Here's your call to action. Integrate an AI-powered guide into your software. You got a guide by your user's side so that your customer can navigate your product intuitively and quickly. Visit commandbar.com/twist to get a custom live demo.
So I have brought to you a round that you will not like, but I want to talk about it anyways. So we're going back to the world of Web3, and we're talking about a company called Story that just raised $80 million. Now, the background for this is that OpenAI is now doing customer tuning for their 4.0 model. OpenAI just landed a deal with Condé Nast, and Anthropic is getting sued. So I'm thinking a lot about AI models and data for training still, and that brings us to Story. So Andreessen Horowitz's crypto team puts $80 million into Story, $2.25 billion valuation. And Jason, I'm going to walk you through what it does, and then I want you to tell me...
Did you say $2.2 billion valuation?
No, I said $2.25 billion valuation.
So in the real world where that was a stock trading in the market, you would have to have 1/5 of that in revenue. So it'd be $400 million in revenue, $500 million in revenue, roughly. Okay, got it.
Yeah, and you'd have to have, just to have that, you have to have SaaS gross margins. So in your high 70s to low 80s, and you would need to have probably positive free cash flow and at least 15% growth and, you know, net retention of 100. The point is, it's a lot of money, you know?
A lot of money.
So what are they building? They're building a blockchain framework that will tokenize, don't laugh, I'm being serious. They will tokenize IP to get it onto the blockchain. No, I'm not.
Is this like you're punking me?
No, I swear to you.
It's just like an ICO. Okay, keep going. Sorry. They're gonna with the Breslow story in this story, I feel like we're just like going back to an era where I was banging my head against the desk in confusion. But sure, keep going.
Then they're going to monetize the IP that is on the blockchain by, quote, giving creators the ability to set the economic terms for how AI can use their IP. And then all of this is programmable, so you can call it if you need to and then access it. And really slick website. I had Court pulled this up because I think they put a lot of clearly budget into graphics. And the reason why that Andreessen has done this, Chris Dixon and Carol Wu from their team said that, you know, these AI systems today are likely trained on original human-created content, but often don't credit or cite their sources. If there's no attribution or compensation, what incentive will there be to publish original creations on the open internet? Okay, so I agree with that. I like a venture capital round. I'm not a big crypto guy, but hey, you know, I'm flexible. Knowing all that, Jason, how much money would you put into this deal at the terms that Andreessen Horowitz just accepted?
Oh, on these terms, $0.00. And I would say this is foolish. And Chris Dixon's a smart guy, but I think they have a giant fund of LP money sitting there and they need to put it to work and they need to make big bets here. But if they put 80 million in at a 2 billion plus valuation, they own 3% of the company. 3%. Okay.
It's nothing. It's less than a seed investor's target for a seed round.
Exactly. I mean, Y Combinator owns 7% of a company for 125. So if you just think about where you're putting capital, this is dumb. Now, listen, I don't know the founders. They could be the biggest geniuses in the world. This could be Sergey Brin and Larry Page, and maybe it's worth overpaying, but I don't think so. And I do think that although this idea makes some logical sense, I think, and I do think it should exist, And I am an investor in a company that is doing a clearinghouse model like this. And I think there will be many clearinghouses, one for books, one for music, just like the music industry has clearinghouses. So the clearinghouse concept will exist. Large brands, New York Times and Condé Nast, will cut direct deals, Reddit, because they can, Twitter, et cetera. And those people will go direct. And then there'll be the medium part of the tail. And then the long tail will need services like this. I think it's going to be a grinded out business. I don't think it's going to ever make the amount of money necessary to get what needs to be at least a 10x. A 10x here means this becomes a $25 billion company. A $25 billion company would need to have $5 to $10 billion in revenue. It's not going to have that. There's not enough money here, but we could be missing something. The other weird thing, I don't know if you saw, the SEC was looking into some VC firms in the crypto space. I'm not saying that it's Andreessen Horowitz, but the idea I have here is, I think the SEC is very interested in venture firms putting money into crypto projects, having tokens and selling those tokens to retail or to anybody. And I've talked about it more here. So I don't do crypto deals at all. People send me crypto deals. I'm like, I'm out. Why? Because they're overpriced, like this one. Two, they are incredibly speculative, and none of them, literally none of them, with the exception of Coinbase, maybe some NFTs, companies that are now close to worthless or extremely low value, the only thing that's worked is the crypto exchanges. In other words, the marketplace where they sell the tulips works.
I think there's one other thing that does work, which is...
Okay, tell me, please.
Stablecoins. I think stablecoins have done quite well.
Oh, sorry. I forgot stablecoins. So yes.
Circle is a company that's going to go public. I mean, we're going to have Circle back on the show in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah.
Getting that locked in actually by now.
Journey
and
later.
So Circle, Coinbase, and then the list gets pretty short, frankly. I mean, I know
Kraken,
a lot of people... Kraken. Okay, fair enough. But again, that falls into your exchange... That's an OG business model that has one foot in fiat and one foot in crypto doing quite well. And so to me, that's like a hybrid versus a full crypto business. By the way, on the SEC thing, were you referring to the point in which the SEC was looking at VCs to see if they were acting as unregistered securities dealers?
There's that piece. And
there was the Uniswap news that came out a couple of days ago.
Yeah. So Block Tower reported this. There was a podcast where somebody talked about it. And what I believe is happening, and I did listen to the podcast where this person talked about it, speaking on the Unchained podcast on Wednesday, Ari Paul, the chief investment officer of Block Tower Capital, said the SEC has launched a, quote, bunch of investigations into VCs who are acting as unregistered securities dealers, as you're saying. The discounted token deals that some VCs ink with crypto project puts them in violation of the regulators' strict securities laws, Paul says. And so what's happening here is if you were to buy, invest in one of these companies and then they have a token, where does the equity value sit, Alex? Is the equity value in the corporation that you invested in? I'm going to make up a company now. This company is Ubercoin, and it's going to make a decentralized ride-sharing network. You put your car up there, you have users, it matches them, it puts it on the blockchain, and you just disintermediate Uber. There doesn't need to be any central location. You just add your car to the blockchain, and it knows the location, blah, blah, blah. Okay, silly idea, but whatever. Okay, I invest $80 million in there, and I own 3% of the company, like this deal we just saw. And then they launch a token. And the token has, they launched 10 billion at 10 cents each. So there's $1 billion now in value in the token. And I, as the VC, get my 3% of those tokens. So I gave you 80 million to invest in the company, but because I own 3% of the company, they said, I'll give you 3% of the tokens as well. There's $1 billion. That's $30 million in tokens. And the token spikes, goes 10x. Now I have 300 million. So I sell half my tokens. I make 150 million. I send it to Harvard and Yale and you know, Mubadala, whoever the LPs in my fund were, and they get that money from the public, consumers, randos bought the token. Then the token collapses and becomes worth, you know, 1/10 of 1 cent.
Yep. And you know what that is? That's an engine that takes money from people who don't have a lot of money, but are chasing the GenBet, you know, philosophy of chasing a big win.
Oh, GenBet. Good call.
Yeah, it takes that money from GenBet, funnels it through a fee structure involving VCs and founders, and then it takes most of the profit from those poor people and gives it to foundations that have tens of billions of dollars. It's not exactly economically accretive the way you lay it out. I'm not stoked by this model that you're describing.
If that had occurred, would Gary Gensler, Elizabeth Warren, AOC, you know, in that contingent of people who, let's say, are, what do they call themselves? Democratic socialists?
I don't think Gary Gensler would account himself.
Gary Gensler wouldn't. He considers himself a capitalist, whatever. But I mean, those people who kind of support this legislation, who represent constituents, they're going to look at that and be like, wait a second, wealth transfer. And they're looking for the wealth transfer to go the other way. They want to see a more balanced society. What you described sounds like stealing from the poor and giving to the rich.
It does sound a lot like that.
What they want to do is steal from the rich and give to the poor. So this is going to cause, if this is true, and any venture capital fund did this, the optics would be so crazy that if this, and that's why I think the SEC started double clicking and asking questions. And, you know, I've had the SEC come to me, you know, and other folks. And when they think they see fraud, and this is a case where I think I had met with a founder, but I didn't invest, but they knew I had met with the founder.
Sure.
How did they know I met with the founder? Well, obviously they got records that I was on their calendar and a high profile name, you know, SEC calls you. And then I'm paying a $2,000 attorney and I'm submitting information saying, yeah, this is my notes from the call and here we are. And then you never hear from them again.
So you just send it in and they ignore you afterwards.
Precisely.
Wow. Okay.
It's kind of like, I don't want to say they're on a fishing expedition because I don't think that they have some nefarious purpose, but that's how it feels to you. Because you naturally, as a curious person, are like, why are you asking? And they're like, yeah, we're asking. And you're like,
great.
Am I involved in this? Is somebody in my organization involved in this? We didn't invest. Why would you want our information? Like, yeah, information. And you're like,
Okay. It's like if you see a cop car parked outside your house and you're like, did I break the law? Did I do anything wrong?
They're just eating donuts.
But your blood pressure goes up several gradations and your doctor begins to get mad. So I have to ask, Jason, are you talking about Solana in this analogy that we're discussing?
No, actually wasn't, you know, and I think that one has come up because some of my besties were involved in, they had invested in a fund that then were investors in Solana. And so far, everything I know about Solana has been on the up and up. Yeah. But, you know, all it takes is like, because I had said on the All In podcast and it became like a clip where I was like, I don't understand the valuation. Like, are you guys long this thing? Are you selling it? And we kind of joked like, because if something doesn't make sense in terms of valuation, you sell your shares.
Going back to the Ryan Breslow thing and $14 billion. Interesting.
If you were a shareholder and it was worth $14 billion and somebody offers you secondary, you'd be like, okay, that's
how much do you want?
Exactly. And, you know, I had that happen once or twice, you know, during peak ZERP, some people offered to buy us, you know, buy some of our shares. We took advantage of that secondary. And then I, you know, I had people who were LPs or people who were in syndicates. Hey, why are we selling 10 or 20%? Because you as the fund manager are trusted to make these decisions for better or worse. And so, you know, you sell just a little bit of your Calm or a little bit of another company or a little bit of your Uber, you have to then justify it. And what I would just say to people is, we don't know what's going to happen in the future, but we do know that this offer came in and these offers don't come in too often.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we thought it was prudent to sell 10 to 20% of our position. And if the offer comes again at a higher valuation or the same, we might sell another 10 or 20%. So that's always been my philosophy, which is, you know, on the way up, you can pare your position a little bit. Do you feel like an idiot if it goes 10x after you do? Maybe, but it depends on where you put that money. If you took that 10% you sold at a peak valuation and put it into NVIDIA, and then that went 50x, you would feel pretty smart, right?
Of course.
So you always have to ask yourself, well, what did you do with the capital after you got it back? And then some industries, you just have to return capital at some point or you're not in business. If you're a private equity firm or a venture firm, if you do not get DPI, as we discussed the other day, you're out of business, right? So you just...
Oh, absolutely. I think shaving off 10% to de-risk and return cash and make everyone happy makes perfect sense. It's the old farming point. Pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. And so I think a slight de-risking is okay. But that's also my personal philosophy towards risk, which is I like to have a roof. I like to have a job. You know, I'm not willing to have the variance go so high that it all goes away at any point. I bring up Solana not to accidentally subtweet your friends. That was a mistake. But it wasn't the intent, I mean. But the reason why I bring it up is I think there was like a big venture investment. I think Andreessen was involved. There was a token presale for Solana, and it was called a VC coin for a long time in the crypto community. Now it's street cred, seems to be pretty good. But I was always kind of curious, if you bought it and then you sold some, and then it turns out that it was a security, how much liability might you have retrospectively? And I don't think that's been fully teased out by the legal system yet. One last note from me on Story. We've talked about Tollbit. We've talked about Human Native. These are companies that are building trad web platforms to let people take their content and put it into the bucket and then get some payment for it. We are now going to get to see a natural experiment between a database that is private and a database that is public. And we will see who comes out on top. We did have Tollbit on the show a couple of weeks back. Lovely people. And we'll see how they're going to do.
You know, the other thing about these pre-sales is when you do a public offering, you have a lockup period. You have audited financials. You have like a roadshow. You have filings. With a lot of these pre-sales, there was a massive discount. There were not lockups, or the lockups were negotiated one-off. In other words, you're the founder, I'm the VC, you got five VCs, you got three angels, you cut two, three different style of deals with us. I say, I'm going to buy, you know, 10 million of the tokens, but I don't want a lockup period. The other people say, I just want to buy 100,000 tokens. You say, okay, but you got to be locked up for 2 years. And you're like, okay, well, I guess that's all I can get. Can I get 18 months? Like, okay. Now, the person who wasn't locked up, they start selling on some schedule, and then the other people who are locked up don't, then collapses. You get the idea of what can happen, right? When Robinhood went public, it was about $50, $60 before we distributed at, I think, I don't know if it was 18 or 22 or something in that range. Well, I mean, but that valuation was never real. You know, Cathie Wood was buying at 50, 60 a share, if I remember correctly, and then it came back down. It was like a one-day spike. You know, and so again, we have to then go to LPs, and they're like, didn't it hit 60? I was like, yeah, there was like an AMC weird thing that occurred that we didn't get to participate in because we distribute in 6 months, the end.
Well, that's good to have a pattern. I mean, companies, I forget if it was Sequoia or someone else, said that they were now going to hold equities in their companies they'd invested in after they go public. And then because they did that, they got their face ripped off and the market turned. As long as you're consistent, I think it's fine. As long as you have we do this, we've all agreed to this. But I think if you try to start timing the market after an IPO, if you're a private market investor, you're just asking to make a mistake because that's not your game. That's not.
And some
what
people are good
for
at the game. You know, you look at a Sequoia, they have heritage. They had a family office offering and they were very good at it. And they knew holding Google and other things post going public was a good idea. So, you know, hopefully, you know, and those investors, I think, get to choose if they want to be in that public thing or not.
Well, I mean, back to the point of clarity, optionality, and, you know, just being above board. Basically, everything that's not going on in the Bolt deal leads to very good business results, normally speaking. Just do whatever Ryan doesn't, and maybe that'll work out for you.
And we have one final story, I think.
Oh, yeah. We're just something really quick about layoffs, just because I wanted to touch on this, because we've been talking a lot about static team size here on the show. Basically, companies not hiring more as they grow, you get more leverage out of each employee, greater profitability. And Jason likes to say about how AI is going to help people do more faster. So each person's more productive. You can essentially have leverage. And then, Jason, I'm watching some companies in the tech world that are big names, Cisco and Intel, just take out the knife like they're trying to cut off an arm. Absolutely brutal. And so Cisco's cutting 7% after it cut roles in February. Intel's cutting 15,000 people. and they're trying to save $10 billion next year. Here's my question. I get static team size, because often adding people is at least a less productivity and more complexity and so forth. But if you're looking at a company like Intel that is clearly behind the innovation curve, yep, and you're slashing that many people, we have a chart here of the biggest tech layoffs of the year. You can see that Intel and Cisco are both rather high on that list.
Yeah. But this is by raw numbers, right? You have 26,000 people at Dell, which is 20%.
Yeah.
So there's percentage and there's raw number. These are big percentages and big raw numbers, to your point about the cleaver.
Yeah, the blood's flying here. And so when you see these massive layoffs, is it the company saying that we made a mistake and we overhired and we're just trimming the fat? Or are they saying we can't afford to do what we need to do with these people? Or 15,000 people from Intel and 7% from Cisco. It's just an enormous reduction. Talk to me about this.
Permission to speak freely?
Oh, go for it.
Okay. I'm going to say some things that are going to hurt some feelings. Okay. There's a war right now. There is a war between management and shareholders and employees in America. Okay. It's a war. And it's a multifaceted war. But people, because this is their paper, it's their jobs, it's a very sensitive topic, right? And this is a multivariable war. There's work from home and return to office. And then there is efficiency, there's age discrimination, and then there's top-heavy organizations. And then there's natural efficiency. You know, there are people like Jack Welch, rest in peace, at GE, who felt 5% should get cut every year. There are people like Netflix, Patty McCord, and, you know, the team over there. They felt everybody on the team had to get rehired every January. You had to state your case if you wanted to keep going at the company. So, what we're seeing in the market right now is you never waste a crisis. And because of the overhiring in tech, the legacy companies are looking, and they lag, but they don't lag forever. They saw what Twitter, Zuckerberg, Microsoft, and Google did in terms of right-sizing. They saw the productivity gains, and they said, you know what? We want a little bit of that. We want a little bit of that, because management knows that in a company like a Cisco, right? When you brought up Cisco, we're in town. There are people who've been there for multi-decades. And I have great sympathy for these people, because they're our generation. They're boomers, they're Gen Xers, and then even millennials. And like I told you, we took you in the Gen X draft because you're cool AF and smart. But the millennials can claim you as well. The point is, boomers, massively overpaid, at the end of the career, less energy, less desire to crush it, generally speaking. I'm painting with a broad brush here. Then you go to Gen Xers, maybe they're slightly overpaid, you know, and you've been at a company, and then they're looking at this next generation, or, you know, the AI native generation that people talk about. Sandeep Mondra was talking about that on the AI program recently. Just this, you know, AI native generation is more efficient. And so I saw this in the PC era, where, you know, legacy people didn't have computers on their desk, and Gen Xers who didn't know how to use computers were 10 times. They're just not wasting the crises. They're using this as a way to get rid of the overpaid old people. Okay. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but there are people who, you know, were at Intel or Cisco for 20, 30, maybe even more years. They got 5, 6, 7% raises every year. They doubled their salary every 7, 8 years. They got stock options. And now the company's like, you know, we just don't need this many people, because your job is now being done by AI. And so they're just trying to get rid of all of that, what they consider fat, dead weight, overpaid, old people, and just cut them. That it's really brutal. And then I watch these people, because they're on TikTok crying. I have a great sympathy for them. And, you know, it's almost like it's hitting my age group too. I know people who are in their 50s, you're in your 40s, you know, like people in their 50s are starting to feel this. I have contemporaries who are like, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get another job. I don't know if I'm going to get a job at the same salary. What am I going to do? Because I still want to work 10, 20 years. And so, and then forget about like international and globalization, where you could hire people in Portugal, Manila, South America, and Canada at a 25 to 75% discount to do that same work, and, you know, AI doing some amount of it. So the war continues, and
I have a couple of thoughts about that. I do, so capitalism
does
it, is...
Do you think it's true what I said? I mean,
the thing that I quibble with is the amount of people, because Cisco couldn't have had enough people that have been there for 20, 30 years to fill the scale of the cuts we're talking about. Intel didn't have 15,000 of them. So I think they're probably also cutting down some other places. And if they are making these cuts as absolutely painful, one or two time things to clear up cash flow, to put it into the right part of the business to grow. Okay, painful, I get it. But if the company was so poorly run that up until 20 minutes ago, they thought they needed all these people because they hired them, they staffed them, they insured them, et cetera. I doubt their ability to actually chart the right path forward. And then the third thing that I've seen at companies that go through layoffs, having been at companies that have had layoffs, is once you begin to do that, all the people who can leave go, oh, it's that now. Okay. And then they bounce and you end up cutting what you think is the dead wood, but then you lose the top of the pyramid.
And you could lose some great performers who feel like there's a chance. Yeah. And you go, I think anything under 10% in this kind of market is probably pruning. And, you know, when you're in that 5 to 10%, it's kind of in the Jack Welch pruning, not a big deal, efficient. When you get over 10%, something more is going on. Also, people were hired. Got to remember, we went through a very competitive decade where people were, rightfully so, you know, and it's a pendulum, but talent was scarce and there was massive competition. And what did that lead to? It led to people correctly getting the best deal they could in the market and maybe leaving jobs to get, you know, 30, 40% raises. And they do that twice in a decade. And all of a sudden, you know, somebody who is making X is now making X times three. And then people wake up and go, wait a second, how did this person wind up getting this salary? Wait a second, that's a big number.
Oh, you just explained something to me. This is why everyone gets a 1% raise. Because that way you can never end up doubling your, like at my last job, which was owned by Yahoo, which is owned by Apollo. Like the end of the year would come around and they'd say, we really appreciate your contributions. You get 2.25%, which is more than most people. They got 2%. And you look at them, you're like, bro, inflation's 5. Like what? You're going to pay me less?
I mean, it's
year?
Like cost of living adjustment. It's like half of the cost of living adjustment.
Yeah. And so I think that's probably been instituted to avoid the situation that you're describing, in which if I got a 7% raise every year, I mean, I would retire making oodles of money, you know, that would be fantastic, but not super viable.
That's why people always say you have to, if you want to get a big jump in pay and you're an elite performer in the top 10%, mm-hmm. you have to basically go out and test your worth in the market. And, you know, that's a fine thing for people to do. And
it struck me as inefficient though, from the corporation side, because you know how much it costs to staff up, to have an HR department, to source candidates, to bring them in. And then they leave because you won't give them more than a 2% raise. The incentives there are strange. But Jason, you asked for a question. We have one from our dear friend, Mr. or Mrs. Patucci, let's say.
Okay.
Hey, Mr. Jason, what do you think of future uses of blockchains that deal with storage? Would it replace today's clouds? And does it seem cool to store your stuff on a blockchain, but not sure to invest in it? Essentially, do you think that Filecoin is the future?
You know,
sorry, I didn't
storage
read
keeps getting cheaper and cheaper and more reliable. And so anything to do with blockchain and storage, you know, and making it theoretically cheaper is just not going to work because every time I go to put a hard drive into a new computer, or into a rack or a server I have, I'm just like, what? Have you seen how cheap hard drives are?
Oh, it's absolutely insane. Like, I mean, Jason, nuts. Give me the price of a 2 terabyte drive right now. What would that cost us?
A 2 terabyte drive? I don't even know if they make 2 terabyte, but I'm going to think
is
it's
that too
50
small?
Bucks. Yeah. 10 terabyte drives. I think most popular hard drive size now
you
is probably
portable.
8. I think 8 is... Oh, you're talking about portable. That means it's got to have a power supply and a casing.
I'm saying that I found a 2 terabyte one. It is portable and it costs $80. So the point is that yours is going to be 35.
Yeah. So, you know, if you were to look at the cost of, you know, I don't know, like I think 8 terabyte are the standard enterprise ones now. An 8 terabyte might be $100 to $200. 4 terabyte, $100. So, you know, we're down to... Guess that's like $10 a terabyte, $20 a terabyte. Yeah, it's $20 a terabyte right now. I mean, it's bonkers. So blockchain, this is the thing. Blockchain is a very inefficient database style. It's because you're replicating it across many servers. It's immutable. It can't be changed, or it can't easily be changed. You might be able to change it with like all the servers agreeing to take something down if you architect it that way. But almost nobody wants that database format. The only people who want an immutable public blockchain is people who, you know, want to know the custodianship of, like, I don't know, an NFT, and it really matters that you can see who it changed hands with. And it seems like it's obscure, like nobody wants it. And so that's always my thing. Bitcoin is now a almost 2-decade story, and we don't have crypto writ large is a 2-decade story. We don't have anything outside of stable coins and exchanges to show for it.
All right. I have a spicier question for you. So Keith Kritzelis asks, do you think that net job destroying companies or automation, things like AI and robotics, should be taxed differently than job creating companies? Now, this actually fits into my unified theory of economics, human progress, and robotics that I haven't written down yet. But I'm curious what you think here, Jason.
I mean, it could come to that. I think that's, you know, why Sam Altman did the UBI thing. I think there are some delusions of grandeur here where it's like, we're so amazing at what we build that we're going to get rid of so many jobs that therefore we have to be the god kings and queens and float down and sprinkle all of, you know, a small percentage of the money we make on you peons to let you live at home and suckle at, you know, the teat of AI. It's a little deranged, if I'm being honest. But that is an interesting idea of, you know, putting a tariff on a robot that kills jobs and then redistributing that wealth. It's not insane to think that there's an analogy here, Alex. You could take the toll road and say, we're going to charge for this toll road and put that money or some percentage of it toward public transportation. So you're paying to go in the fast lane, $5 a day. We're going to take $2 of that and make it for the subway system. And people have thought of that kind of scenario. And I kind of like those. I like the idea that the congestion tax in a city like London or Manhattan would go towards improving public transit. So you have this thing where, like, the billionaires, you know, Mike Bloomberg is zipping down Broadway in his, you know, Maybach. I don't know what he drives, whatever he gets driven in, you know, his Suburban. And he doesn't hit as much traffic, but he's got to pay $20 to go in that zone, right? And these D-bag bankers in London go in the finance center. I think they pay $50 as a congestion fee or something crazy like that. Like a day to drive their Ferraris there. Yeah.
That adds up.
Let me ask ChatGPT before. What is the cost of the congestion pricing in London?
By the way, Jason called the lawyers D-bags, not your friendly Alex over here.
It's actually not that bad. Let's see. The London congestion costs are as follows. Standard charge $15 per day, auto pay $14 per day, and late payment after the day of travel $17.50. So it's £15 a day, which is a little bit more than dollars. So it's 18, yeah. It's $20. But if that $20 goes towards making the tube better, kind of like it.
The tube's kinda great. Like my first time on the tube, having spent a lot of time both on Amtrak and the New York subway and Caltrain and BART, I was like, wait a minute, you can have a really nice subway? This place is spick and span. It was warm. It was lovely. There was didn't smell like pee. You know, like,
I was in Manhattan for 2 or 3 weeks with my daughters and, you know, I'm team Uber, obviously, but, you know, it's like in Manhattan, there are times when taking the subway 5 stops is a lot faster. And even going to Brooklyn to see my family, I took the subway, I would say 3 out of 4 times now. It's literally taking $100 or $200 Uber Black, which is what I take. I take the Uber Black most of the time. It's not cheap, but it doesn't make any impact on me. But I prefer the subway because I want to get there faster. And I like the subway. I like seeing other humans. I like being part of the mix. I don't want violence or a crazy person attacking me or my daughters, but I kind of like it. I like the vibes. I like being on the subway. My daughters prefer it as well. So
yeah. I remember in San Francisco during kind of the peak of the last the pre-COVID tech era when I was there, you know, if it was less than a mile and it was across anything in Soma, it was always dramatically faster to walk because traffic was so locked up. Because not only was it slow once you got into your Uber, but they would have to start 7 blocks away on the wrong part of Market Street and then noodle their way over to you. And then I think I lost a bunch of weight because I was just hiking everywhere across the city. So, you know, that stuff works out.
Hey, and I just asked ChatGPT 4.0, and when I open a new window, it goes there. And I asked it, where does the congestion charge money go? How does the government spend it? And according to ChatGPT 4.0, public transportation improvements, walking and cycling initiatives, environmental programs, ultra low emission zones of electrified buses, road maintenance, and traffic management technologies. So
all that hippie communist stuff we don't do in Texas, you know?
London's congestion charge generates approximately 230 million pounds annually.
Wow.
Pretty amazing.
That is pretty amazing.
And then they net 155 million of it after operational costs to invest in public transportation and cycling. So I kind of like it. So if you, to the original question, if you make robots, if you got the Optimus or the Humane, and it takes a factory job, maybe that goes towards re-education or food stamps. I don't know. Like,
I mean, what would a 10% tariff on it, just to slap, figure out what the replacement cost is, tax 10% of it, they get a 90% savings, the robot company makes a sale, everyone wins. Tough to do.
All right, everybody, thanks for tuning in. Yeah, Twist500.com. We've picked over 80 of the companies. We're looking for a full-time journalist to join us here. We'll probably work for Alex and do one interview a day. If that sounds interesting to you, email alex@launch.co.
Alex at launch.co.
If you're interested, we're looking for somebody full time to do this. Okay. Maybe an Austin.
All right, everybody. That is our show. We are back with more interviews, more news, and the Twist 500. Before you know it, stick close to us. We are on YouTube, every podcast app, and social media. We'll see you there. Jason, bye.
Bye-bye.